You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
You are now listening to Kill Your Lawn and Kick Your Fence. Kill Your Lawn and Kick Your Fence is brought to you from the stolen lands of the Wurundjeri Woi Wurrung people of the Kulin Nation. I would like to acknowledge that sovereignty was never ceded and pay my respects to elders past, present and emerging, and to any First Nation listeners tuning in today.
Slums in some metropolitan centres are coming down, condemned by forward-looking civic governments. Down are coming the bad living conditions that produce bad citizens.
The practical uses of asbestos are very numerous. At least 18,000 articles are made of it.
In the spring, the nature-loving Australian goes bush. The wife washes and the dishes dry themselves.
Amy is a serial pest.
Cities within cities, scientifically planned and built, where a man and his family with a small income can live with comfort and dignity as investments in democracy.
Out of the rubbish tip and straight to your ears is me, Amy. We've got a jam-packed show for you today, but before we get to that, I hope you caught Dissociative Identity Disorder Awareness Day broadcast yesterday at 2 p.m. If you didn't, you can head to www.3cr.org.au/DIDAD2026. And you can listen back to conversations I had on dissociation and trauma, with the theme this year being navigating medical systems. Also, if you've been following my contributions on Stick Together about green jobs, if you catch up on this week's episode of Stick Together, you can hear about some of the research I've been recently doing into the Melbourne Strategic Assessment and the Geelong Strategic Assessment. I've recently discovered what they are, and I am diving deep into research mode. I've got some guests who can enlighten us about it coming up in future episodes. And yeah, it's an interesting topic. If you don't know what they are, that's probably intentional on the part of the state. But basically, the assessments made to decide which spaces will remain as Indigenous or protected Indigenous sites in the burbs and cities of Melbourne when it comes to the Melbourne Strategic Assessment, and their management. So far, the Melbourne Strategic Assessment management doesn't look like it's been going too well at actually looking after environment and biodiversity. And the Geelong Strategic Assessment is just about to be voted on. So you can head to 3cr.org.au/stick together to learn more about that. And getting back into Kill Your Lawn and Kick Your Fence territory, we've got two really exciting conversations with two really exciting groups today. One is Permaqueer, a really fabulous duo that you'll hear about all in just a moment. And a group that should be familiar to regular 3CR listeners, the Friends of the Earth Sustainable Cities Collective. I have recently gotten involved with them on their Better Buses campaign. I may be riding some buses with them and bringing my microphone along in the coming future to talk about buses in the West. And yeah, so stay tuned for that after this interview with Permaqueer.
Thank you. Tēnā koe, Amy. Thank you for inviting me on. Ko Guy Toku Ingoa. My name is Guy. I am from Aotearoa, New Zealand. I come from Ngāti Kahinuniki Wairarapa, Ngāti Toa Rangatira, and Ngāti Kuata, which are three tribes from the bottom tip of the North Island of Aotearoa and the top tip of the South Island. I am a compulsive creator is what I will say, with my fingers dancing in a lot of different ecosystems at the moment. I'm one part of the network of Permaqueer. I work across climate justice and artivism across the Pacific, Aotearoa, and a range of different other food networks, with a major focus on community organizing and food justice and sovereignty.
Yeah.
And I'll leave that there. I'll pass to you, Toad.
Thank you, Guy. Yeah, my name is Toad. I'm one of the other people who work in Permaqueer and one of the co-founders alongside of Guy. Yeah, I'm a permaculture teacher, permaculture community organizer, and also youth ambassador for Permaculture Australia, kind of existing in the ways of like just wanting to have those kind of conversations about like what does permaculture look like outside of white middle class backyards. That's kind of been a lot of my work within Permaqueer and in the permaculture movement and also in other spaces as well. It's, Guy's an incredible artist. I'm an incredible little nerd when it comes to other things in the ecology of the work that we do.
Yeah. Amazing. And why create Permaqueer?
Oh, that's a great question. Initially, where Permaqueer came from is it was during the 2019-2020 NAM lockdowns. We were living in a little permaculture share house, and we both, Guy and I both managed to learn permaculture from our landlady, who kind of had these really equitable models for like learning permaculture and community living and things like that. And we both kind of thought it was just like some hippy-dippy gardening. But yeah, we didn't really think too much of it. But then when the lockdowns hit, we built kind of a community economy around us. We'd actually really focused on food security, community care. We'd had like a dumpster diving redistribution network as one of the permaculture designs. And despite being really low income, we had housing security, food security, and a lot of community well-being. So we kind of initially started permaculture to kind of teach what we had learned to our queer and other communities as well, just to kind of empower them with that. And that was just the initial little step in that direction, but it kind of took some interesting twists and turns, which I might pass to you, Guy, to share a bit more about.
I think, you know, there was a real challenge for us in the permaculture space, just because of the sort of cultural dominance of sort of white Western Australian values and how that integrated into our queer communities, our Indigenous communities, POC communities and urban areas, it just didn't work. And so it was sort of out of necessity that we started realizing all these food systems, these housing systems, these like community systems, they work and our communities need them. And so contextualizing them into ways that our communities could understand and interact with in a way that wasn't harmful then just resulted in it blowing up in our faces in the most beautiful ways. And so we ended up doing these web series all across the world, teaching on every continent except Antarctica. It was actually really overwhelming and we were not ready for it, and we learned a lot along the way. And so ever since that, it's this sort of ecological design, food systems, sort of design-based sovereignty has splintered in many, many directions because of the need. You know, everyone lives in the world that we live in right now. And so what Permaqueer is now is truly just responding regeneratively to what we need at the moment, which is so hella vague, but it's underpinned by a lot of community consultation and interaction, and what we've come to land as regenerative design. So, yeah.
And so there's a couple themes in there that I want to talk about, but I suppose that one of the things Permaqueer brings to all those different communities is a set of values. So while it may be hella vague, you also have a set of values and approaches that you're bringing to those situations.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Did you want to talk a little bit about some of those values? I know relationship was a really big theme of last year's Permaculture is Political.
Yeah, thank you. I think that, being able to like kind of succinctly talk down to this is really kind of a really fun challenge, actually. One of the really important things that drives Permaqueer is that things be First Nations led, as well as focusing on self-determination. So like supporting people to lead as opposed to creating things for people. Another really big value of ours is queering, which we have a really beautiful, succinct definition of that by Hannah Breckbill, which is the interrogation of social norms and the building of new relationships and systems to meet the needs of all.
Mm.
And I'll handball it over to you, Guy, to speak to our values.
Yeah. And I also want to pay homage to, you know, the design methodology of permaculture and what that has informed. The three ethics that underpin that, earth care, people care, and fair share or future care, which I think underneath all of the design work that we do and, you know, regenerative community, mutual aid, all of these things, if they don't have those a core practice of those ethics underneath them, they actually just mimic the systems that we're in. And that's why these ethics are so important. And, you know, I do believe that the values and ethics that we as Permaqueer have integrated, you know, with these other values, allow a more nuanced and context-based response that's fit for our communities. And so, I think in a lot of our work, we really want to talk about these really critical queering and you know, other values that we have, but they have to work in concert with these other values and design approaches. And so, in a lot of ways, we see those as just the basics of ecological design and how we can be in harmony with our environment, which in the sort of permaculture world takes a very separate sort of view of who we are as a human culture, which is why that First Nations First and Indigenous sovereignty is so important, because that decolonizes the separation between us as human beings and as cultures, living, breathing part of country around us. And so,
So in many ways, it's also a decolonial project, because there are so many so many words from the Western world or concepts from the Western world that particularly like our broadcasters here at 3CR will often criticize. They'll say something along the lines of, say, there's a socialism sort of thing happening. So socialism, yay, certain aspects of socialism. However, sometimes for First Nations people, it can feel like another Western colonial construct if it's not done with, you know, if it's not got a decolonial part to it, for example.
And I think, you know, part of that decolonizing this space is understanding what the responsibility for treaty making is, and treaty is an agreement between two parties and two peoples. And I think, you know, there's a lot of critique from all Western movements of liberation, because it's just trying to get closer to what that place-based, context-based, culture-based approach is. And And also, we do need these movements so that Western colonial societies can find those stepping stones to be integrating. And that work shouldn't be done solely by mob. It shouldn't be done by First Nations communities. And so I guess in a lot of ways, this is an experimentation, you know, as all decolonialism is. And here we are.
And I think the other thing I wanted to pick up from that was, and this probably gets into permaculture, is political and queering permaculture. But one of the things I've talked about on the show with other queer activists is and it's a very old discourse in queer politics. And it is actually that word queer, because the broader society, talk a lot about the cities and suburbs, and they cater towards a nuclear family. They cater towards heteronormative lifestyles and ways of living and ways of thinking, and colonial ways of thinking and ways of doing, capitalist ways of thinking, ways of doing. And there is a pool for LGBT plus people to assimilate and become homonormative. And it's a very long conversation, but one of the things I kind of want to resist in my approach, which is an ongoing practice and it's a constant self-reflection, is kind of resisting the gentrification of queerness.
I think that's, apologies for interrupting.
I'll park it there.
Thank you. That's a really, really big piece for us, is how to, I think there's an element of queering or like queerness, which is like, you know, it's, it can be antagonistic, it's clowning, it's creating new ways of culture, community, living, loving, thriving amongst a society that's trying to erase you or invisible you or assimilate you. I don't think that assimilation is the pathway towards liberation, and I have a really strong value in that. I'll let you speak for a bit, Guy, because there's something I'm forming in the back of my brain in response to this.
Well, I think, you know, that whole what is development, what is growth, what is gentrification, and I think within, you know, the confines of urban Western visibility, it's really hard to know what growth is outside of this, you know, gentrified sort of capitalist extraction model. And I think that's why coming back to those ethics and principles of how our environment works around us, and understanding what pattern knowledge is, understanding what seasonal knowledge is, understanding how water operates, once we build these literacies of recognizing our environment around us, we can recognize what is best for the living ecology, and that's reflected in how our cultures behave, that's reflected in how First Nations cultures behave. And so that's why I think a design methodology, and I really like, you know, the core of this co-pop of this project is about agency. How do we have agency to come up with different ways of being and different ways of doing? And within that, queerness is so important, because we know what we have isn't working. We know what we're doing is slowly, not even slowly, really quickly killing us from the inside as cultural environmental creatures. And so we have to have other ways of thinking. We have to have principled queer approaches that are just like, hey, that's really fucking weird. That's just totally bonkers. And that doesn't look like anything. And that reintroduces that diversity, that reintroduces. And once that's paired with how our ecosystems grow, and how in nature, how water, how soil, how all of these bedrocks of existence, once those find alignment, that's when we start to create these really generative cultures and these ways of being and these approaches. And when I think about treaty building and treaty making, that's the attitude, that's the capacity, that's the practice that we all need to have. I'll pass back to you, Toad, if that's clicked a bit more in your head.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you for speaking so eloquently about that. And if I zoom in on one thing that you said, particular, Amy, about the gentrification of queerness, I see this in a lot of movements of liberation. Like, I'm a big freak for systems thinking. So for me, I'm like, beyond just the languaging or the frameworks, like, how do complex systems organize apart from just the values of things like, you know, patriarchy or white supremacy, beyond just that initial value? Like, how do they, even when you take out those particular kinds of, oh, this person is better than that person, what are the kind of patterns of those systems and how do they operate? Because we can't use those patterns to dismantle those systems. Like, for example, like, I can use the language of feminism to be a misogynist. Yes. I can use the language of anti-racism to enact my very whiteness into the space. So for us, it's like, and this idea of queering being gentrified, I think that like queerness or like true queering breaks homogenization. It introduces complexity. It focuses on interrelationship. And I think that the gentrification of queering is the homogenizing of all experiences. This, if I get a little bit nerdy, very like kind of neoliberal identitarianism, this like, this flattening of complexity and flattening of relationship and context. And for me, like what we do at Permaqueer is we teach systems thinking in a really non-threatening way through ecology. And that's the way in which we can, for example, like we can talk about the function of a monoculture. Collapses complexity down to simplicity. It's really good at mass extraction. And, you know, there's many times less nutrients in a crop of tomatoes than there is a food forest. But, you know, we'd have that homogenization for that mass extraction. They're prone to pest, disease, and collapse. Suddenly, because everything's are no longer collaborating or cooperating, they're competing. So you see this purity politic emerge. Anything that blows in is seen as a threat to the purity of the crop. So I kind of teach about that from an ecological perspective, so then I don't have to do a huge amount of work when I say, well, what is the function of a social monoculture? And just like we have, like in an ecosystem, you can't monoculture your way out of a monoculture. Homogenization, purity politics, mass extraction isn't going to undo a monoculture, and it's not going to undo a social monoculture.
It's the ironic thing, just on purity politics with it, when the your politics, even if it has like a left-wing origin, could become carceral logic. It could actually become policing of how to be. For example, I could say, I could be so against the assimilation of queers that I start policing what a queer should be. And it's very tempting to do that, actually. It's actually something we have to be mindful of as we go forward in the world.
Yeah, I think, you know, if you've grown up in a colonial Western context, generally you're given a very select set of tools. And, if, you know, like that thing, if you only have a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And really what we're trying to focus on with permaqueer and the whole queering ideology and the kind of ecological design is, what are the other tools that are available to us? Understanding through complexity, through ecosystems, through interrelationship, how do we diversify our toolbox and become a bit more discerning about which tool do we use where, and that these tools are not always scalable. These tools are not always transferable.
And I think as well, in you know, in terms of agency and in this sort of queer regenerative design approach, our focus, you know, is acknowledging that each ecosystem will self-organize to its, you know, its community's needs, and how do we create environments that are conducive to doing that, and that within the confines of Western, all the Western structures that we have here in so-called Australia, they sort of really pressure a small window of decisions that it wants you to make. And so a lot of this work has been exploring what self-determination is, what agency is, what are the conditions for sovereignty to emerge, and also what is this concept of pseudo-sovereignty that we're offered by these systems around us that mean the decisions we make about housing, the decisions we make about food, the decisions we make about care and relationship, we make this the same set of decisions to continue down that pathway of supporting these systems. And so Yeah, it's been a big exploration about how do we create conditions for sovereignty? What are the mechanisms? What are the design relationships that we can build to ease that pressure so that it's not pseudo-sovereignty that we're making decisions from? Because we will always do that as human beings on this earth, as a socialized species. And how do we create some more freedom in that? And I don't think we necessarily have the answers for that, but we've definitely been playing around with that for a little while.
Yeah, and I think that is part of, because you did the talk Queering Permaculture at last year's Permaculture is Political. I think that is part of what being queer is. It is playing around. It's not really defined, and it shouldn't be. It's always evolving. I guess the most prominent speaker right now on gender who people are familiar with is Judith Butler, and they refuse to give a definition of gender, for example, because that is probably impossible, but also restrictive and imposes things onto it that could be oppressive or restrained.
To counter Judith, I do have my definition of queerness. So my definition is you know how you've got that little filament in your eye and you try to look at it and it keeps moving away? That's queerness.
Nice.
Yeah.
There's kind of a lot of things that are coming up to the fore at the moment as well, particularly in terms of the way that we imagine, for example, essential work and also sort of essential community life or essential caregiving, and how those function. If we think about sort of the way that queer family often takes very, very sort of different forms and very, important and meaningful forms that often don't match the picture of normative, heteronormative family life, but how so many of the affordances or the restrictions or the kind of the governmental sort of imagining of the way that we should live and what we need to live and what we need to survive really is shaped around heteronormativity. It's around the family life in the suburb, as opposed to many, single individuals who have shared queer family, both sexual and community connections that sustain them and that kind of give them life and give them sort of energy and comfort and safety and security and support.
You're listening to 3CR Community Radio 855 AM on digital and online. 3CR Radical Radio.
Come to the Degrowth Festival on Sunday the 22nd of March from 11 a.m. till 7 p.m. Building community and resilience. Let's create the world we want by practicing it now together. Sing, dance, picnic under the trees, and check out the dozens of stalls, workshops and talks. The 2026 Degrowth Festival, Curtin Square, Carlton. Search for Degrowth Festival 2026 on Humanitix for more details and to register. The Degrowth Festival is a 3CR supporter.
You're tuned into 3CR Community Radio. You're here with Amy. You've been listening to an interview that I just did with the wonderful Toad and Guy from Permaqueer. That is part one of our conversation. You will be able to catch up on part two on the next episode of Kill Your Lawn and Kick Your Fence. In the meantime, I highly encourage you to go check out their YouTube channel, where you can find lots of talks from last year's Permaculture is Political, an amazing array of guests, and we're going to be talking about Permaculture is Political on the next episode there. And I also encourage you to check out their Queer Regenerative Design course. It's already started, but it sounds like something that they do on a regular basis that you can keep an eye out for. So I'll put links to both those things in today's show notes, and you can check them out while you wait for the next episode. We're now going to turn to an interview I did with Better Buses for the West, Friends of the Earth Sustainable Cities Collective. Let's get to it. Welcome to 3CR Studios, guys.
Thank you.
Maybe starting with Elise, and then we'll go Simon and then Grace, just introducing yourselves and what your role is within Friends of the Earth Sustainable Cities Collective.
Yeah, sure thing. Hey, everybody. I'm Elise Cunningham, and I've been the coordinator of the Better Buses for the West campaign at Frenzy Earth Melbourne for coming up 4 years this year, 3.5. My pronouns are she, her. And yeah, just we'll take a small moment to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands that we all work on. Wurundjeri, Woiwurrung, Bunurong. That's generally where we run our campaign activities.
All right.
Yeah, hello, Simon.
Hello, everyone. I'm Simon Tran. Pronouns are he, him. So I joined the collective, I think, a couple months or so after the state election in 2022. Mm-hmm. And I actually found out about the elective just as a community resident that was based in one of the areas that the collective focuses our work on, which is the western suburbs of Melbourne.
Mm.
So at the time, there was a forum being held in Brimbank, just like getting the, you know, people who knew stuff about buses to have a chat with the community residents, and also getting councillors to and state politicians to talk about buses. And through that, I was like, wow. So there are people who are doing stuff on things that matter to me, like buses. And so I decided, you know, I'll just join. And I've been here ever since. My kind of specialties are like, so I do a bit of help with the community organizing side, do a bit of share some random tidbits on like political strategy every now and then.
Cool.
You
bring the fashion?
I do bring the fashion,
such
apparently.
Good fashion.
I have a
You should see Simon today. He looks incredible.
Yeah.
Rocking it. So stylish.
My personal, like, real interest in, like, I guess public transport policy is actually around, like, things like how it impacts childhood development, how it impacts, like, society and culture in general, and also how, like, it is very much correlated with, like, almost like life and death, like safety.
Yes. Yeah.
So I think it is like much, much more than just a transportation issue, or like, you know, even like a greenhouse gas issue, or cost of living issue. It's like so many things and more.
Yeah, yeah. And we might get into a bit of that after Grace. So Grace, how about you tell us about you?
I'm Grace. I have lived in Melbourne for about 8 years now. I moved to Werribee almost 4 years ago now. And I lived in the inner suburbs earlier, so around like Albert Park, and then actually lived like around Seddon, Yarraville area. And when I moved out to Werribee, it was obviously an affordability thing, and we had just had a baby, so we wanted a bit more space and all that. But I was pretty shocked at the poor public transport out here. I knew that there were no trams, but I had seen on paper that there was a bus network, and thought that that would kind of do just fine to get me to the train station and, you know, around locally. And it turned out not to be the case at all. I also at the time was working on Sundays in the city and working like sort of an evening shift. So when I got home to Werribee Station, the buses had all but stopped running. And it wasn't that late, I should say. It was probably around 8:15, something like that. I was just looking around at all the people waiting for the buses in the station, and a lot of them were, you know, elderly people or people with small kids who should be in bed by that time, you know, but it's so hard to get home and takes so long to get home that they're stuck out there. And, you know, people with mobility issues, things like that. And I just started thinking, this is crazy. And I wanted to, I was about to whip up my own campaign. And then I discovered through, I think, the Wyndham Facebook page, I saw that that Better Buses was holding a forum for the Werribee by-election. And I wasn't able to make that particular forum, but I reached out to Elise. And yeah. I said, hey, like, I want to get on a campaign. I was taking a class in organizing at the time as well. I thought I wanted to sort of adopt this campaign as my my new pet project, I guess. And so Elise and I had a coffee and got to know each other a bit. And I've been involved ever since. And I came on in a paid capacity as well, I think from, I want to say, July of last year. So I'm officially a community organizer for Sustainable Cities. And I do a lot of the sort of groundwork out here in the West when it's sometimes not as easy for Elise to trek out all this way to get stuff. But she's out here a lot also, I should say.
Yeah.
Providing support out here. Yeah.
Can I just say as well, it was such a godsend to have someone approach me, approach the collective and be like, hey, I live in Werribee and I care about this issue and now I want to dedicate a bunch of my time every week to working on this campaign, which was like last year when we were really struggling for resources as well. It's, we really love when people do that. Hint, hint.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I've now attended a couple of meetings and you are such a lovely, diverse group of people. A lot of optimism and like a fresh desire to just do something, and I think that's really exciting and it's a good energy to have in a group. I thought this show, Kill Your Lawn and Kick Your Fence, takes a look at our urban environments in a way that's quite intersectional. So we could say take your you could take your like local street and you could analyze it through a different lens. If it's in a suburb, you could say that the suburb is designed to facilitate a capitalist model of having the little worker drones all in one area and then use their petrol fuel, fossil fuel guzzling cars or their lithium mined cars now that destroy Indigenous land to go to the workspace. And you could also look at how the boxing of houses facilitates the nuclear family and how inclusive is that for queer and also just for women, as there's been a lot of history of women coming into community together to share various labor. So there's so many different lenses that you can take. You can take a racialized lens. Obviously, there is still visible segregation in our cities and suburbs. It really just is such a big topic. But what I like to ask people who are into this sort of thing is, and I'll temper it to your group name. What is a sustainable city to you?
But I don't know. I suppose, like, to apply, I guess, a gender... You can apply any of these lenses, I think, to looking at our campaign that's based around public transport. Like, something that we talk about a lot is how the transport system across the city is really structured around cis, white, able-bodied, middle class, working age individuals. Like, that's primarily who our whole transport system is like catered to. Obviously, we have a really car dependent city, so that requires people to have a certain amount of money. And, you know, it doesn't really account for any kind of level of climate justice. So I think a sustainable city to me is like the opposite of where we're headed now in terms of transport, at least. Like, I think a sustainable city is one where people, no matter their income, gender, race, class, like whatever, are able to move around freely and with ease and get where they need to go when they want to go there. And it's about, like, I think enabling not just equal, but like equitable access to participation in community. Like, I think that's a really important thing that we probably don't talk about enough, is that like when people don't have a way to get around, they're very limited in how they can be politically active or socially active. And yeah, obviously, like, there's so many other implications for people's health. There's implications for the climate. Safety is a really big concern for like communities in the West. So yeah, I think there's just so many things that make a sustainable city. But I think, yeah, primarily it's just a city where people can get around where they need to go with ease.
And I guess,
and without having to use a freaking car.
This is such like a wide ranging like topic. I feel like
So
many of the things I think about these days do relate back to like how our cities are designed, yeah, how they're designed, and how, and the way like people assume things are, I guess, like how they're meant to be when maybe there are like other ways to do things.
Really? There's another way?
Surprise.
You're not saying that like there's like thousands of years before us of different societies, and especially on this continent, of people doing things differently?
Exactly.
That's wild. I can't believe you said that.
I just thought of an example that is quite nerdy, actually. And it's the fact that like in a lot of video games, when you make a video game, like a space in the game or a map where, like, you know, you have your little character and they travel around the town and they interact with, you know, the computer characters and stuff, they don't design it like the way we design our suburbs. And that's for a reason. They know that like the way we design our suburbs are not interesting. They're not fun.
Yep.
They're not designed for people to live in and for people to just enjoy life and engage with like other people.
Mm-hmm.
And you find in all these games, they all like try to hark back to like olden times where things were more dense. Mm-hmm. So, you know, a lot of mid-rise housing, mm-hmm. A lot of just like public pedestrian street areas.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
you've got to run them over. That's like what you do in half of those games.
Maybe the more very American ones like GTA.
Yeah.
Actually,
with the density of people around, it creates interest, right? It creates a story. If you can see the people walking around, you get an idea of the world you're in. It's part of the world building of video games. And exactly, one of the themes that I've seen in our modern society is we're alienated from one another. Mm. Our cars are little boxes. You know, it's actually part of that story and world building to immerse you in it is the people, right? And that's not something we have at the moment. We have alienation.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that does tie in with, one of my interests is like the way that society and culture is impacted by the way we design our public transport and like just our spaces in general.
Yeah.
But maybe perhaps back to the core question of sustainable cities. And I do think perhaps a bit of an issue here is actually that our collective has become so much more than just being about sustainable cities.
Mm.
But to then just talk about the sustainable cities, I do think there is one element that I believe in, which is that the cities should be somewhat self-sustaining or designed in a way that is where there is a need for subsidy, it is done so like in the interest of the major, like everyone's needs.
Yeah.
Where right now we have, you know, so much space and land allocated towards entrenching car dependency. So you can just look at a regular shopping street and you'll notice that, like, wait, hold on. I thought this was a shopping street. So that's like a place for shopping and then a street, which is like a place to be at.
Mm-hmm.
Yet 80% of that space is allocated towards transportation, mm-hmm. but not, you know, and like the worst kind of transportation, the mm-hmm. least efficient kind of transportation. And that just like obviously means there's so much almost like unsustainability in that design of that street.
Yeah.
And people don't realize that when you pay for a lot of the on-street parking, sometimes it's free, but even when you pay for it, it almost never like pays for itself through your parking fees.
Hmm.
And like councils are always having a hard time trying to fund these.
Hmm.
Yeah, and whilst instead you can just have that land put aside to be used for like, you know, this little like more seating for like a cafe.
Yeah,
and that
more greenery.
More greenery as well, yeah. And that so have that green space or just like productive space.
Yeah,
just brings in so much more value to the community.
Mm. And value that isn't measured purely in a monetary sense, because parking brings in revenue, and that's probably something that some councillors on certain city councils really like the idea of when it comes to this back and forth debate in a lot of councils of parking spots versus bike lanes.
Yeah.
But I could keep talking so forever, but I want to get to Grace. tell us what is a sustainable city to you? What do you kind of think about in sustainable cities land?
Well, I found myself furiously not belong to a lot of what you guys were all saying, and you know, I echo a lot of those sentiments, particularly what you said at the very beginning about what do you say, walkable cities. So I love the idea of the 15-minute city. I know it turned into a conspiracy theory at the end of COVID, but the idea, you know, that you can access most, if not all, of your basic needs and a lot of your community as well within a sort of walkable or cyclable range is a lovely idea to me, and it just makes a lot of sense. I would say, too, interestingly, that concept is more real in sort of the inner suburbs and, you know, the CBD areas as well. And it's kind of contrary to stereotype. I can't speak to what a country town is like, but it, you know, I always kind of grew up with the notion of like, ah, oh, like people in the city, they're so unfriendly and stuff like that. And it's people who live further out who have more of a community feel to it. But when I actually moved out to Werribee, I noticed there's much less foot traffic everywhere. And as a result of that, people don't see each other. I barely know what my own neighbors look like because everybody just gets in their car, which is in their driveway, and then goes along their way. And there's a lot of effort put into things like green spaces out here and playgrounds, and all of that is really nice and lovely. But most of these playgrounds are empty most of the time, because I think when I lived, like say when I lived in Seddon area, people who stopped at the playgrounds with their kids were like on their way to the grocery store or they were on their way to pick up something else. And that created just a de facto community vibe that out here, I think it's not that there's no community. Like I don't want to just, you know, trash Werribee at all. Like, you know, I hope it doesn't come out that way. But I do think just the design of the place, like the fact that it's so car dependent, it just naturally doesn't create opportunities for people to meet each other as friendly or neighborly as they might be in personality. So there's that. The other thing I would say a little bit in the same vein is that another issue, you know, besides transport and climate that I've always cared about a lot is family violence and housing and poverty in the context of housing, like homelessness and things like that. So I think that there is a lot of, I know that there's a lot of private suffering that happens behind closed doors.
Yes, and, I agree. I've talked about it on this show.
I'd like to go back and have a listen. But I think that being able to move about and also have adequate housing would be able to sort of break open all those silos where people are sort of suffering in their own way and in isolation. Even if it's not necessarily family violence, I hear so many stories of elderly people or people's parents who come over and they're just kind of left at home all because they can't get around. They don't drive, or, you know, they're too anxious to drive or something like that. And that just creates sort of a loneliness epidemic. And I don't think that that's sustainable in the long term. Mm-hmm. I think that all these other confounding factors like cost of living and unfortunately sort of increase in racism and things like that have left people in a place where they're not optimistic about the future. And I would love to see a world in which people felt like, you know, their kids were going to grow up in a sort of healthy, cohesive society, and that people don't have to bear the weight of everything alone or say in their own sort of tiny units, you know, family units. So that is really important to me. I would also say that on the sort of social cohesion note, I have unfortunately noticed a sort of these infrastructural issues, say like traffic and things like that, have sort of engendered a bit more racism, unfortunately, and towards sort of the new migrants who are out this way. It's a very diverse population. And I think a lot of people, rather than looking at the planning side of things are just jumping to this conclusion like, oh, well, all these people are coming in and it's ruining everything. And I absolutely know that that is not sustainable. I think that a world in which migration and movement across, you know, either different suburbs or in and out of the country, that sort of thing, that can actually be withstood without this sense of scarcity that people have around, like, there's only so much room on the road and there's only so many houses and there's only so many this. Like, we need a better design so that people aren't feeling pinched and blaming their neighbors for things that their neighbors are not responsible for.
Yeah, I love it. And I think, you know, we're getting such a great sense of this group and what you believe in and the importance of this in relation to the climate movement, because, you know, it's, I know Friends of the Earth is part of building that movement. Let's dive in now to the Better Buses campaign. Anyone can jump in here. Let's start with what's going on. What's this bus campaign? Let's tell us all about it.
The Better Buses campaign. All right. So what we're trying to do is get the state government to transform the bus network in Melbourne's western suburbs from the long, winding and convoluted routes that we have now that, if you look at a map of the bus network, looks like a bowl of spaghetti and doesn't make any sense, into a fast, frequent and connected grid of clean electric buses. We, since 2022, we've been working with researchers at the University of Melbourne. So Dr. John Stone, with his colleague Ian Laurie, published a paper called Better Buses for Melbourne's West. You can look it up and have a read through their research. But they basically mapped out what it would look like to redeploy the existing buses into a grid-based network using the current operational investment. And they found that I think the most mind-blowing statistic that I always like to throw out there is that in Hoppers Crossing, the amount of people within 30 minutes of their nearest activity centre increased by 1,155% just by changing where the bus routes are actually going. We have been organising around this campaign for the last 3.5 four years. It actually started before I joined the collective. It went through a period of kind of online, you know, it was like a COVID kind of period. But then, since 2022, we ran some community forums around the state election that year where Simon found us and joined the collective at one of those forums. And we've, been building towards, I guess, getting buses and bus reform into the wider narrative, which I think we've been really successful at. I think a lot of people are talking about buses now, including in the government, in the media, at community forums, like everyone's kind of talking about buses. And I'd like to think we have a stake in that. You know, we had a role to play in that.
Yeah, absolutely.
We're working with like local communities and local groups to build their capacity to campaign for bus reform as well. Mm. I think a big part of our kind of campaigning is that storytelling element, which we try to do in various ways. So if you go onto our social media, Instagram is just @better_buses, and scroll through, you see we've got a few like videos of people telling their stories from their words about, you know, what they're going through and what Better Buses would mean to them. We've been supporting people to like go and lobby their member of parliament and things like that. God, I feel like we just do a lot. Like our work is so varied. But I'll just kick off with like...
I hear we're going to be riding some buses.
Yeah. Well, part of our video storytelling. So we have a big event coming up at the end of March on the 28th, a community symposium called The West Deserves the Best. Mm-hmm. Why Does It Always Get Less? Where we're bringing together like grassroots community members, social service sector organizations, community orgs, to talk about like this historic and current underspending on infrastructure and services in the West and how that's impacting people and how better buses could really help to alleviate a lot of the pressures that are being caused by all of these other issues that the community are facing. And we're kind of like doing that under the banner of what we're calling transport justice, which is, I guess, you know, when we're having that conversation earlier about like, what is a sustainable city to you? And like, thinking about even just the name of our collective, I think is something that will, I don't know. I'm always like pondering on it. Like, should we change it to the Transport Justice Collective? Because to me, that feels like it reflects more deeply like what it is that we're actually doing. Like, it's not just about sustainability and the environment. Like, it's truly about justice for people that have been ignored and forgotten by the government for years.
And that's the theme of the climate movement right now. I think maybe one of the criticisms for a while of the climate movement is that it's been a bit, it hasn't really tied in other issues of the world, but it everyone seems to be realizing that a lot of the issues we face are all connected.
Yeah, you can't put them in silos. Like, it's ridiculous. Yeah. Like,
and you know, the justice is such a big question. Like, the clothes we wear are provided by the global majority, and they are literally running out of water to provide us our clothes, to provide us our data centers for AI. There's been an awful article in The Guardian recently about that. Whilst we still have drinking water and usable water here in the global minority, because to fuel our lifestyles, we've taken so much from the global majority. Does anyone want to tell me a little bit about your stalls? I hear you do these interesting little stalls where people can come and say hi.
I could talk about that. So as part of like just some, I guess, almost like marketing or campaigning for our event that's coming up in the end of March. We have been attending a bunch of like farmers markets and other type of, you know, the small communities events, and just like setting up a stall there.
Yeah.
And just like, when people pop by, they see like all of our, I guess, our materials, and they start getting the idea of like, oh, I guess buses are like a thing.
And how's the community responding?
Quite positively in general.
People are interested.
I've had a few conversations where people would just see our stall and they just walk up and they'll be like, oh, maybe I should take the bus.
And we got heaps of signups. We got heaps of signups to the event at the most recent stalls last weekend, so if you want to come along, get in quick.
That's awesome.
It's been quite successful. But actually, like, that person who said that, oh, maybe I should take the bus, if you think about it, it's actually strange that they haven't already been taking the bus.
Yeah.
And so they said that, like, for their situation, they've just naturally, like, I think they're, like, rather young adult, like, maybe late teens or, you know, early 20s. And they've just naturally gravitated towards taking an Uber everywhere.
Oh, cool.
That's
very good. That's awesome.
Just spending all their money on Uber.
That's just like, you know, they follow the natural inertia of their life and trying to get around, trying to do things.
Yeah.
That just somehow has become the most almost like a convenient way for them. And
it's created a whole new tier of exploitative jobs.
And it's clearly not sustainable.
I feel like that really exemplifies how bad the car dependency is in the West. Like, it's so deeply entrenched that people don't even consider buses as like an option because they've been so bad for so long. And I think one of the biggest issues, like, maybe Grace, if you want to speak to like the issue around how bus reform has been done in the past and like what's different about what we're trying to do. Do you want to speak to that?
Yeah, for sure. Well, it seems like over time, over the last few years, specific communities, and this is a great thing in itself, have advocated for bus lines to get out to where they are, particularly like in the newer estates. I'm thinking of Mamburan and now Atkinson. I think both of them have recently been have secured a bus line. I don't think it's out there yet. Maybe you guys can correct me if I'm wrong on that. But I also know that there are the new law courts built out in Wyndham, the Wyndham Law Courts right next to the police station. That's a whole other kettle of fish, but basically West Justice managed to get an extra bus services out that way. So essentially, the approach with organizations, but also the response from the Victorian government, has been to just add a line here and there, or maybe add an extra bus on the same line. And what we really need is a complete rethink of how things, how buses work out here, because it really hasn't changed in a very long time. And the population, by contrast, has grown just exponentially and is only going to keep kind of exploding out in this region. So I think the bus routes, when you look at the actual map of the bus routes, and it's not an easy thing to find, we have it on our website, but the existing bus routes look like they are designed for a small population where you kind of have to go hither and thither to like pick up people randomly on streets, you know, that, you know, where there's, you know, five houses out on the end of that road and there's like a cow pasture and then another five houses kind of thing. Whereas now the population is dense enough that a grid-like system makes so much more sense. And the interconnectivity is also really important because the local, like people get around locally now. They're not all just commuting into the city. There's actually more commercial buildings being built, more activity centers, more community, a lot of times they're called community learning centers, but essentially a community center. They are popping up around everywhere and they actually provide really vital services to people, but people can't actually get out there because there's no bus that goes there, or the bus comes so infrequently, it's almost a useless endeavor to get out there. And actually I was just yesterday speaking to this amazing woman who runs the Iraqi Cultural Group of Australia. And she says she has to go and do pick up for some of the elderly community members because they can't, and that sometimes English is a barrier as well. They just can't get around on public transport. So essentially what the Victorian government needs to do is take a really good look at the needs of the people out in this community and the density that exists out here now and rethink the bus plan completely. And that doesn't mean ripping up every single bus stop that exists already. A lot of routes I think can remain in place, but they need to basically consider it holistically and get just a new system in place. I don't know if it's repetitive or not, sorry.
That's good. I'm just mindful of time, so I thought maybe we could finish up with what the game plan is. What's the game plan? What are we doing, folks, this year? I'm keen to join you on some of those bus rides. Yay. I'm going to bring my microphone along and get some coverage that way, and maybe chat to a few people if we're lucky. What are you doing this year? If people want to get involved, like, what are they expecting to get involved in?
Yeah, well, as you've mentioned, the bus rides that we're doing are part of that like storytelling and to promote the event that we've got coming up in March. And we definitely could use more hands on deck for that as well, to come along and just chat to people on the bus, hand out flyers and that kind of thing. We've got this big event happening at Wyndham Park Community Centre out on Bunurong and Country on the 28th of March. So that'll be 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. and people are welcome to come. And I guess the idea off the back of that, like this kind of event is quite unique or quite new in that, at least for us, like our work has been very much in a little bus silo for the last few years. But we're making a concerted effort to like build solidarity across groups who do often work in these silos and find, you know, more solutions to what the community is facing that are rooted in like people's lived experiences of transport injustice. And off the back of this event, we're hoping to get people to sign up to participate in some like organizing training that we want to run around the middle of the year and build locals' skills in how to campaign and organize around public transport or whatever issue you want to organize on in your area. And then later in the year, like obviously we've got the state election coming up at the end of this year, so it's a really important year for us and the community groups we're working with to be making a lot of noise and doing a lot of, like there'll be a lot of action. And I wouldn't say we have a fully fleshed out plan for that yet, but we are actually going on a wonderful retreat this weekend as a collective, where we'll be like hashing things out a bit more. And I think, like, yeah, if anything really flashy comes out of that, we'll definitely report back to you, Amy. Don't worry, we'll let you know.
Amazing.
But those are the things, yeah, the most important things coming up at the moment is the event on the 28th of March, and we'll have some kind of promo actions in the lead up to that. So yeah, it'd be really good to have people involved in that.
We do a monthly newsletter as well. So for people who aren't able to make the March event, if they want to just search, or, you know, click the link in the show notes, but also search Sustainable Cities Friends of the Earth, it'll pull up our page and you can just sign up and subscribe to our newsletter. And that way you can keep abreast of everything that's happening through 26. Yeah.
And follow us on Instagram at @better_buses.
Perfect. It's always good to have a mailing list because not everyone has social media. So that's excellent.
Yes.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, the three of you, for coming in.
Thanks, Amy.
And yeah, looking forward to working with you and seeing where this all goes.
Thank you. Awesome. Thanks for having us.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.